verses 31 to 32. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Here ends the reading of God's holy word. Let's go through a quick review of what we covered this morning. We basically exposited this passage, but more or less we exposited its parallel passage in Matthew chapter 19, verses 1 to 9. Remember, we covered two issues. First of all, we looked at the Pharisees and their liberal view of the grounds for divorce. Remember, the Pharisees simply saw divorce as a technicality. Provided that you lived up to the prescribed technical merits outlined in Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 to 6, as long as you gave a bill of divorcement, it was a legal dissolution of the marriage. They believed that a man could divorce his wife for any reason. The school of Hillel taught that if you weren't attracted to your wife anymore, you could divorce her. If she didn't cook good enough meals for you, you could divorce her. If she spoke too loud, you could divorce her. And this is why they came to Jesus seeking to test him. And said, Jesus, doesn't say in the law that a man can divorce his wife for any reason? Jesus, of course, rebuts them. And they had a very liberal view of divorce, to be more accurate, a very liberal view of the grounds, a very progressive view of the grounds for divorce. They were progressive conservatives in the true sense, conserving their traditions, but very progressive with God's moral laws. You know, extending the bounds of discretion and morality. And of course, they were caught up with the idea that what Jesus said was what Moses said was unclean, they simply saw as anything the husband arbitrarily deemed disagreeable to him. Well, Jesus rebuts that. And he makes it very clear to them that in no way has he come to do away with any jot or tittle of the Old Testament law. And he reminds them very clearly that from the very beginning, God's law established the sanctity of marriage, right in the garden. And that Moses, the author of Genesis, understood that principle. And so whatever Moses has written in Deuteronomy chapter 24, it's in harmony with what's already established. It's not in contradiction of it. There's no contending. There's no competition. Moses, as a prophet of God, understood that marriage is sacred. So sacred that Moses, under the prescript of God, lists a whole item of legislative laws curbing chastity in marriage. Because marriage is so sacred to God, it's important that people realize they cannot be unfaithful and break this covenant commitment. And so he prescribes law after law condemning unchaste living. And it shows you that God had a very high view of marriage. And so obviously, when Moses says unclean thing in Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 3, he's referring to sexual sins, not to any old arbitrary reason. So what we discover is that Jesus, rather than giving a new ethic or a greater New Testament ethic, confirms the Old Testament law, jot and tittle, its intent, its extent, and its form. Now, what we want to do this afternoon is we want to look at two things. We want to, first of all, very quickly ask ourselves this question, what really is divorce? And then secondly, we want to analyze more carefully all the biblical grounds for divorce. We already heard the Jesus outline. It's not simply adultery in the technical sense, but it is more broadly sexual immorality in the broad sense. And sexual immorality that extends also to immorality of a heinous kind that's not necessarily sexual in orientation. This is very important that we see that. So we want to look at what divorce is, and then we want to look at the biblical grounds of divorce more clearly. First of all, then, what is divorce? Divorce is the formal breaking of a covenant that has already been violated and therefore broken. It's the formalizing of what has already taken place. It's much like baptism is the formalizing of an internal reality. Divorce is the formalizing of something that's already happened. It's making clear someone broke a covenant and someone is a violator. That's what divorce is. It's not a sin. unless used sinfully. Just like capital punishment isn't a sin unless used sinfully. We need to get that straight. Divorce is the formal breaking, the legal, ecclesiastical, and civil recognizing of a covenant that has already been broken and violated. It is therefore the dissolution of marriage, and this point needs to be clear. Since it is a legal dissolution of marriage, it therefore represents that in God's eyes, the marriage no longer exists. Now, there are Christians who think that even though you get divorced, in the eyes of God, they're still married. No, that's not the case. Unless, of course, it's been an illegal divorce. Right? Unless it's been a sinful divorce, therefore leading to adultery. But if it is a legal covenant breaking, then in the eyes of God, this is what this formality represents. That in the eyes of God, these two people are no longer married. And that the union in the sight of God has been broken. Undone. And secondly, it is familial punishment. It is a familial sanction. That is, to put it this way, it means that the violator of the covenant has been disinherited. Now, in our culture, it means nothing. Because we're very atomistic, we're very individualistic. So, to say this to somebody today is meaningless. Who cares about being disinherited? Because people really don't care about inheritance, about long-term prosperity, about long-term commitments, about the long-term reputation of their name or their family. People don't care about those things. So it's really pointless in that sense. But to those of us who understand better, especially to those of us who are post-millennial, this means something, to be disinherited. It is the familial extent of excommunication in the church, so to speak. Although it doesn't have the same spiritual connotation necessarily. That's what divorce is. The formal breaking of a covenant that already has been violated. The dissolution of marriage. The ending of a union in the eyes of God. It is familial punishment. Now, let's stop for a second, having said that, and realizing that that's exactly what Christ enunciates here in Matthew chapter 5, verse 31, 32. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced, you know, under the wrong pretense, commits adultery. The point here is that some people will say, okay, very well, Pastor, we'll grant you that Jesus doesn't really break the intent of the Mosaic legislation as far as the grounds for divorce. But what Jesus does do is replace the Old Testament sanction for adultery with divorce. So that now, no longer is capital punishment the necessary remedy for adultery, but it is divorce. You understand the argument. And so what they're really saying is that Jesus still has made a change. He has instituted some kind of change. And we need to deal with that because it's very important you understand. My argument is that Jesus changes nothing about the Old Testament except for the ceremonial aspect, which includes the sanctions. He hasn't changed those. But the argument here is when Jesus is dealing with adultery, he says that divorce is the punishment, the sanction, the remedy of dealing with this sin, not capital punishment. Right? Because look, furthermore, it's been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces a wife, except for sexual immorality, causes her to commit adultery, he says nothing about capital punishment. Well, it's a faulty argument. Why is it a faulty argument? Jesus did not broach the subject of Old Testament punishment for adultery. He's not dealing with adultery and its punishment. He's dealing with the legal and just grounds for divorce. They're two different issues. Completely two different issues. The subject matter of Matthew 5, verse 31, 32, and Matthew 19, verse 1 to 9, is divorce and its lawful grounds. Why? Because the Pharisees had perverted the lawful grounds. They'd extended them well beyond the biblical ramifications. It is not adultery and its civil sanction. It's not dealing with the state. And we need to be clear about that. How can you say that, Pastor? Well, remember, by reason of sphere sovereignty, I hope I don't have to explain that one. I don't think I do. What is the legal redress of one institution, for instance, the family, a governmental institution created by God? Divorce is the legal familial sanction within the sphere of family. Does not necessarily preclude another institution imposing another sanction. And this is sometimes where Christians really get mixed up. You see? An innocent party within the family, let's say a husband, whose wife has committed adultery, he may impose, as the head of that family, a civil sanction against his wife. He may divorce her. That doesn't stop the state, if it was biblical and therefore responsible, from addressing it as well from the standpoint of its social ramifications upon society at large. Why? Because the state has been given the keys to create an environment of peace and prosperity for the church and the growth of godly families. Therefore, it's responsibility to deal with social problems. Adultery is a social problem, just like it's a family problem. And it also then would allow this church to step in and say, you know, there's an ecclesiastical, spiritual issue here at play as well that we need to deal with. And so you could, in one circumstance, find someone who's getting it from all three spheres. Divorced, excommunicated, put to death. You could, hypothetically. You could also discover that the individual is not divorced, is not excommunicated, because they have repented. The victim has forgiven them. They have that right. The state, however, addresses the problem still within their recourse. Now, they may take into consideration all these other things, like repentance, like that he's still within the church, that they've dealt with their problem, and thus maybe deal with it that way. But they still, to the extreme extent, may deal with it. And that's what I want us to look at. What are the biblical grounds for divorce? And do the biblical grounds of divorce preclude the state or the church from dealing with the issue? Christ reiterated in our passage here, both in Matthew 5, verse 31, 32, and Matthew 19, verses 1 and 9. The Old Testament standard concerning biblical grounds for divorce is koineia, uncleanness, sexual immorality, in the broadest sense of the term. Now let's take a look at what are all the expressions of this word, of this uncleanness, which allows for someone to sue for divorce, and yet does not preclude the state from getting involved. Well, first of all, we have adultery. Whether man or woman, Leviticus chapter 20, verse 9, reads, "The man who commits adultery with another man's wife, he who commits adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death." Obviously, this would force the situation of divorce. The death would end the marriage contract, period. The point I'm making, though, is in the case of adultery, many Christians today believe adultery is not as serious a sin as it was back in the day of Moses. There are far too many Christians who are willing to accept it as not being a social problem. One needs to be dealt with radically. Too many. Adultery, I mean, I'm not standing here as a guy that is excited about this. Excited about seeing adulterers dealt with or adulteress dealt with this way. It's a serious thing. But God's Word says it's serious. You can sue for divorce, but it doesn't stop the state from getting involved, if it were biblical. Two, rape. Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 25 and 26. "But if a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside," that is, a woman who is engaged, "and forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lays with her shall die." Here directly you see a man, perhaps he's married or whatever. We're assuming things here. I mean, rape in itself, but now we're looking at it in terms of marriage. a husband or a man goes out and rapes another woman who's married yet to another woman, this would not only be grounds for suing for divorce, but allow the state to get involved. Incest is the same. Leviticus 20, verse 11 and 12. The man who lies with his father's wife has uncovered his father's nakedness. Both of them shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. The man lies with his daughter-in-law. Both of them shall surely be put to death. Again, the state can get involved. Bestiality would be grounds for suing for divorce within the family. Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. Exodus 22, verse 19. Homosexuality, the Leviticus 20, verse 13 and 14. If a man lies with a male as he lies with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. That is, the guilt is on them, and you need not feel guilty for putting them to death. That's what that phrase means. Their blood shall be upon them. They brought it upon themselves. They forced your hand, as it were. There is no option. There's no recourse to get out of it. The guilt has been brought upon them by their own doing. Murder, obviously. Exodus 21, verses 12 to 13. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. Cursing authority is another ground for not only divorce, but the death penalty. Exodus 21, verse 15 and 17. And he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And he who curses his father or mother shall surely be put to death. Kidnapping, wizardry, or sorcery. To read two examples, Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 1 and 5 reads, If there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes to pass of which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods which you have not known, and let us serve them. You shall surely not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice, and you shall serve him and hold fast to him. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because spoken in order to turn you away from the Lord your God. Leviticus 20, verse 27 speaks of a sorceress. A man or a woman who is a medium or who has familiar spirits shall surely be put to death. They shall stone them with stones. Their blood shall be upon them. Apostasy would be grounds not only for capital punishment, but divorce. Notice Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 6 to 10 makes it very clear, actually. If your brother, the son of your mother, your son or your daughter, the wife of your bosom. Now notice the intimate relationship that's established here. Someone in your family or your friend who is as your own soul secretly entices you, saying, let us go and serve other gods. Let's go apostatize. Which you have not known, neither you nor your fathers. Of the gods of the people which are all around you, near to you and far off from you, from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. You shall not consent to him or listen to him or her, nor shall your eye pity them, nor shall you spare them or conceal them. Think about the radical loyalty that God is asking for here in the context of this intimate family relationship. A brother, a son, a daughter, a wife, consequently a husband, leads you astray, is asking you to apostatize, break covenant with God, with Christ. We are told you shall not consent to him or her, listen to him or her, conceal him or her, but you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. Now the point here is not that you can take the law in your own hands, but under the administration of the civil government, you would obviously be a witness against your most intimate relationship, bringing the charge against them. And as a witness under the authority of the state, you would be commissioned to be the first. This is under biblical law. Obviously, it goes without saying, not only would this be grounds for capital punishment, but this would be grounds for dissolving a marriage. Now you think about how many marriages there are today, so-called Christian marriages, where one partner has left Christ. One partner has left Christ. They began as Christians, but one partner left Christ. But regardless of what the state is doing, regardless of the fact the church is turning a blind eye to this, if we want to guard our families, if we want to guard a godly posterity, we need to take our loyalty to God very seriously. That's the point of this passage. Loyalty to God takes precedent over bloodline. So apostasy would be grounds not only for capital punishment, but dissolution of a marriage. 11, unchasteness before marriage by a young woman or a prostitute. Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 13 and 21. If any man takes a wife and goes into her and detests her and charges her with shameful conduct and brings a bad name on her and says, I took this woman and when I came to her I found that she was not a virgin, then the father and the mother of the young woman shall take and bring out the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. And the young woman's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man as wife. He detests her. Now he has charged her with shameful conduct, saying, I found your daughter was not a virgin. And yet these are the evidences of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. And then the elders of that city shall take that man and punish him. Punish him because he brought a false accusation against her that merited the death penalty. It was a very serious charge. And it was found out to be false. So the elders of that city shall take the man and punish him, probably with whipping. And then they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman. And he would then keep on the woman's behalf in case anything happens. Because he has brought a bad name on a virgin of Israel. And she shall be his wife and he cannot divorce her all his days. Which seems almost a difficult thing to consider, given the fact that he's done this to his wife. Why would she want to stay with him? But I'm not going to explain this particular passage in totality today. I'll do that at some future time. But this is the form of the punishment. But if the thing is true, notice this, and evidence of virginity are not found for the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel, to play the harlot in her father's house, so you shall put away the evil from among you. Why is this so disgraceful? Because in other passages in the case law, fornication didn't necessarily result in the death penalty. So why is fornication in this case worthy of the death penalty? Why is he allowed to divorce her and why is she liable to death? Because fraud is in view here. You see, she didn't own up to her sin. She played the harlot in her father's household. She made vows, or essentially vows, marriage vows, by committing sexual immorality with other men. Kept it concealed from her father, which she has no right to do. As a daughter, she is under her father's authority. This is why fathers need to guard their daughter's purity and innocence and decency. This is one of the reasons why we would encourage the whole concept of fathers taking very seriously betrothal and courtship to guard their daughter's purity and integrity. But in this case, what's envisioned here is a daughter who cares nothing for her father's authority, cares nothing about breaking a vow, and basically, in a sense, is cursing father and mother. She's playing the harlot. She plays the harlot and she conceals the evidence. She marries another man under the pretense that she is pure. The man married her under the pretense that she was pure. If she had owned up to it, for example, way back and confessed to her father might have then sued the young man who had taken advantage of her, either sued for a marriage between them or at least exacted money out of that man so that his daughter, as she grows up and discovers that there are a lot of young men in the covenant community who no longer want to marry her because she's been used, so to speak, you know the language, at least she has some financial recourse to take care of herself. That would be the whole reason for what we would call suing the young man for some kind of financial compensation. See? But because she didn't do that, She concealed what she had done from her father, got married to this young man under the pretense that she was pure, and he discovers, lo and behold, she's lied to me. This hasn't come out during the betrothal. I married you in good faith. Now I discover that you are a harlot. It's a worse crime. It's gone beyond just basic fornication. It's fornication with malice and forethought, and it's fraudulent. And Paul has something very interesting to say about the fraudulent nature of fornication in Thessalonians chapter 4. He says, "For you know," verse 2, "for you know what commandments were given to you through the Lord Jesus. This is the will of God, your sanctification, that you should abstain from sexual immorality, that each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God, that no one should take advantage of and defraud his brother in this matter. Because the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also forewarned you and testified. For God did not call us to uncleanness, but holiness. Therefore, he who rejects this does not reject man, but God, who has also given us his Holy Spirit." You see, fornication is not only sexual immorality, but it's a form of theft. Theft against the person that you will eventually marry. It's a dishonor against your covenant head. For boys, it's still the same thing. They're under their father's authority, and it's bringing disrepute to the parents. It's theft against them. It's a defrauding of a future spouse. It's a form of theft. And in the case that's described in Deuteronomy, this young woman didn't report back to her father and confess her sin as she ought to have. And therefore, she got married under the pretense she was pure, and the young man that married her discovered that it was all one big lie. And so he can sue for divorce. He takes her to the state, sues for divorce, and the state remedies the problem, putting her to death. Very categorical. Dishonoring the authority of the headship is in view here. Covenant based on fraud is always voided. So you see, those are all forms of sexual immorality that Jesus describes in Matthew chapter 5 and in Matthew 19 that are legitimate biblical grounds for divorce and also legitimate grounds for the state to get involved in. Peradventure, the state were biblical. And obviously it would also allow the church to get involved. One doesn't exclude the other. There are, however, reasons for divorce that don't give jurisdiction to the state, as far as the Bible is concerned. Other forms of sexual immorality that result in the familial sanction of divorce, yet do not involve state sanction are, and there's three of them, sexual abandonment. We find this in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 2 and 5. Here we read, Paul says, "Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for time, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer." Now, the language here in the New King James Version is fine as far as it goes, but doesn't get to the heart of it. In verse 5, Paul doesn't simply say, do not deprive one another. Paul actually says, do not defraud one another. His point is a little bit more pointed and stated than what you would read in your English translation. Do not defraud one another by withholding your marriage obligations. He couches it in the terms of obligations rather than in terms of your desire. Because often we would hope, if it's a marriage and it's a marriage based on love, this is something the two parties desire to do. But in the case that one person doesn't want to and wants to withhold what they are obligated to give, they are defrauding. Paul speaks here in terms very clearly that to withhold this is a form of fraud. Now, here's the interesting parallel. In Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 10 to 14, sort of in a roundabout way, we get the picture here very clearly that to withhold this from a spouse in the Old Testament was also a justifiable reason to sue for divorce, but didn't involve the state. Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 10 to 14 says, "When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and desire her, and would take her for your wife." Obviously, the idea of sexual attraction is implicit here. "Then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall put off the clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, and mourn her father and mother a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. And it shall be, if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free, but you shall certainly not sell her for money. You shall not treat her brutally, because you have humbled her." Now, there's a lot implied here, and my point is to deal with it as it relates to what Paul says in Corinthians. Just to say one thing, one of the reasons why he couldn't sell her was because she's not a slave. She's not property. She was his wife. He would have to sue for divorce and give her a certificate of divorce and send her on her way. The point here, though, is under the grounds for this. The grounds for it has to do with the fact that the husband finds no delight in her. We need to be very careful again. The Bible doesn't use these words willy-nilly. This has nothing to do with some arbitrary dislike. It has to do with the whole point of why he married her. He was attracted to her sexually. Under the law of God, if you took someone captive, even from a pagan civilization, and she followed the ritual prescript for coming into the covenant, I want you to be very careful here. What this law is not saying is that you could marry someone who is a pagan and leave it at that. If you took someone captive under the prescript that God allowed, because Israel, of course, went into these other nations and took over, and they took captive a woman, she would have to follow this ritual, which in a sense was saying, giving her consent to her captivity in the covenant community. And that is, in a sense, "She shall put off her clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, mourn her father and mother a full month. And the sign of her willingness to do this is that she shaves her head and trims her nails." That she's willing to enter into the covenant. Having done so, if he gets involved with her and he discovers that he's not delighting her, and the intent in the Hebrew is that she's withholding, then he can part with her. It's very important that you understand that. This is because otherwise you'll read this and go, boy, this makes no sense. Because later on God says, don't get married to people from outside the covenant community. And how do you justify this? Remember what I said this morning. The Bible is not a contradictory document. You need to see it within its context. And the reality is the Israelites went to war. We were not a warring nation, so in many ways this doesn't apply to us. We were a warring nation. And as a warring nation, they took over and they received booty. And part of that was that if a man who was at war met a woman that he loved, this was the prescriptive way of getting married to her. But if she withheld, he could divorce her. You could see why she probably would withhold. Perhaps she hated him. Maybe initially she consented because she felt she had no choice. But once being married to him, she couldn't get over the fact that he was one of the men who murdered and killed and whatever her family, and therefore there's no love in her for him, and she just is unwilling to really be his truly devoted wife. Well, because he's taken her, and she's unwilling to be his wife, he can sue for divorce, but this is not grounds for the death penalty. Secondly, financial abandonment. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 10 and 16. "Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, if a wife is not to depart from her husband, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, but if she is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. Here we have an example of mixed marriage, but we also have an example of Paul's prescript to abandonment, because he says in verse 15, but if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. If someone abandons you, up and leaves you, you are not under obligation to maintain the marriage contract. And this is confirmed in other places in the Old Testament. Time is moving on, and I want to get on to this last point of mixed marriages. Mixed marriages in the Old Testament were also grounds for divorce. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1 to 5. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I want to reconcile it with 1 Corinthians. Mixed marriages, Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1 to 5, read this. This is how it reads. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God deliver them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. You shall not make marriages with them. And you say, doesn't that seem to contradict what we just read elsewhere? These seven pagan nations clearly were part of harem law. They were to be wiped out. The Israelites were not to make any covenant with them whatsoever, with these particular nations. Nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their sons, nor take their daughter for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me. So here the Lord lays down the law, don't intermarry with these Canaanite tribes. Then we read in Nehemiah 13, chapter 23, verse 7, in those days I also saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one of the other prophets. So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. And then, of course, we realize that Ezra leads this entire procession and he forces them to divorce their pagan wives. Now, how do you reconcile that with 1 Corinthians chapter 7? Where Paul says, that's fine. You can remain. Context. Context is very important. In Corinthians, Paul is dealing with pagans who have converted to Christ. People outside of the covenant who have converted to Christ. Two non-Christians. One becomes a Christian. The other spouse remains a non-Christian. Under that setting, you can't impose that law. But remember, Paul's using this ministerially. He says, I speak to you, not the Lord. This is my advice to you. If your pagan partner still wants to remain with you, even though you're consistently Christian, and you're living a Christian life, and they're willing to remain with you, then let it be. Be at peace with them. Perhaps through that, over time, they'll come to Christ. Provided they're willing to live with you as a Christian, and that you are able to exercise your Christian life in all of its aspects. But in the law, what we're envisioning here are covenant people who are in Christ already, who willingly go out and marry somebody outside of the covenant. We're dealing with two very different issues. And in that case, what you have is, and Paul absolutely refuses or forbids when he says in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 13, now return for the same I speak to his children, to you, to be open to you, do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? What communion has light with darkness? See, what you need to envision is this. You remember, Paul had received a letter from the Corinthians, and they were asking him a number of questions. And one of the questions they did ask him, what do we do in this case? We know that the law says that you can't marry non-Christians. So what do we do now? Some of us are married to non-Christians, but we were married before we came to Christ. Do we sue for divorce? And so Paul says, I speak to you now ministerially, not legislatively. Because the law of God didn't speak to that. I mean, it does speak to it inspiredly through the epistle of the Corinthians. It does deal with the issue. But the legislative law that was given to a unique covenant people in a unique covenant context didn't deal with this phenomenon. And so he says to them, stay with them. If they're willing to live with you, and you're not having to compromise Christ. That's the catch. As long as you can remain living holy and consistent under the lordship of Christ, stay with them. Now, obviously, it would be an exceptional non-Christian, wouldn't it? It would mean that they would have no problem you going to church and bringing the kids to church. It would mean that they would have no problem you raising the children in a Christian context. That's what's implied here. Very different than marginalizing your Christianity. Very different than a non-Christian saying, I'll live with you, but the kids aren't going to Sunday school. The kids aren't going to church. The kids aren't going to be homeschooled or taught to Christian school. I don't want you raising them as Christians. They're going to stay Catholic. They're going to stay whatever. That would be different. Then you have a situation where the non-Christian isn't willing to live with you, see, as a Christian. And in that case, the Old Testament law would really come into effect. In that case, you would sue for divorce because they're asking you to be disloyal. And they're asking you to allow the children, in a sense, to be subject to Molech, which was also an Old Testament law that you were forbidden to. You offer up your children to a false god. In that case, you would sue for divorce and separate yourself from the unbeliever since they're unwilling to submit to the yoke of Christ. But let's look at it very clearly. Paul says they're willing to live with you, implying all these things. And there's really no point in breaking this covenant contract at this point. See? But to go out now and to seek union as a Christian with a non-Christian, or as our confession states, with an infidel, with a papist, with an idolater, that would be breaking a covenant contract with Christ. And that's forbidden. And in that case, the church would have to step in and start dealing with this individual. Obviously, there's a spiritual problem. But in that case, you can't tolerate that within the church. Now, one last word I want to deal with, Deuteronomy chapter 24. I want to undo a little bit of what I did this morning very quickly. Remember, the Pharisees had misquoted that law. Pharisees believed that simply as long as you had the bill of divorcement, the divorce was legal. Remember that? But as we read, we realized that law basically stipulated this. The remarrying of a spouse previously divorced is wrong. God forbids that. One husband finds a detestable thing in his wife, and he writes her a bill of divorcement and puts it in her hand and sends her on her way. And she goes and she marries another man, and that man also does the same thing, or he dies. The law then forbids her going back to her original husband. Now, I'm sure you all ask the question, why? Why would the law forbid that? Well, remember, in that law, it stated this very clearly. It said, it is an abomination before the Lord for a divorced woman to go back to her original husband who divorced her, or a divorced man to go back to the original wife that divorced him, is an abomination before the Lord. Why is this abomination? Well, there are two reasons. If the ground of divorce were valid in the first case, if the man or the woman really had a reason to divorce this person, and the woman or the husband has now been doubly divorced by someone else, the person who initially sued for divorce compounds the problem if they take them back. If the problem that existed to begin with has never been remedied. You see the point? That would be an abomination to God. You sue for a divorce because you find some detestable thing, that is, fragility, perhaps, in East, either the husband or the woman, refuses to have relations, and so the person sued for divorce sends him on, and this person goes and marries someone else, and they have the same problem there, and it's not being dealt with. Church can't deal with this person, and no other counseling can deal with it, and they divorce the person. And then the first husband or the first wife takes pity. They develop a friendship again. They begin talking with each other again. And eventually, let's come back. Let's try and work this out. After having no evidence of change, then you've compounded the problem. That's the point of this passage. Either his or her initial grounds were fraudulent, or they were valid, making the union an impossibility. This speaks to the issue of battery, drunkenness, and gambling. How does this speak to that? I want you to think about this. Many of you have probably never had to deal with these problems. And thankfully, I haven't had to deal with it too much either. There is a rampant problem in relationships, especially abusive relationships. Generally, the husband abusing the wife. Beating on his wife, for example. Which, by the way, would be valid reason for suing for divorce. Husband beats on his wife time and time again. In many of these cases, these women find themselves hopeless. They don't know what to do. They're very insecure. They don't know where to turn. They're afraid. And in many cases, the church has turned its back on these people. Because the church itself seems to be incompetent, doesn't know what to say in this case. Well, anyways, for some reason they sue for divorce and they leave their husband. In many cases, they just up and walk away. They separate. Eventually, they divorce. But down the road, because the problem of the wife's insecurity hasn't been dealt with either, she finds herself very alone, very afraid, financially unstable. She's got children. She doesn't know what to do. Her husband, initially, she had divorced, seems to change a little bit. Or appears to have changed. And they begin to strike up a relationship.